Yes, now? Everybody can hear me? Terrific. I want to welcome everyone to FLEX, Strategies for Thriving in a Multicultural and Multigenerational Workplace. My name is Beth Carlson from Raytheon Company, and I am proud to be your host for this morning's session. Raytheon is proud to participate, and I, of course, am as well. Participate in and support, actively support, the Massachusetts Conference for Women, especially on its 10th anniversary. I'm sure I'm not alone in having been to this conference for a number of years, and it is incredibly exciting to see year over year the added dimension of more and more women. It's just incredibly inspiring and motivating and exhilarating, and I hope that that you all feel the same. Our title sponsorship with the Massachusetts Conference for Women and for this event really does reflect our ongoing commitment to building and supporting an inclusive culture at Raytheon, as well as to supporting the advancement of women leaders, not only across the Commonwealth, but across our nation, and as we continue to expand our global footprint across the world in those countries where we have an opportunity to make a difference. We are delighted that the conference is just one of the many ways in which we support the power of the community of women through our armed services support, K-12 education, higher education, and volunteerism. We support women in their daily lives and in the ongoing journey of continuous learning. Raytheon employs people all over the world, and our employees donate their time and their talents to make a difference in the lives of others. We're particularly passionate about STEM, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, STEM education, and that's why Raytheon has joined US 2020, a White House initiative created to mobilize 1 million STEM members by 2020. And in fact, our STEM mentoring programs include two, which are particularly close to home for Massachusetts. I just want to speak to those briefly. The first is Stand and Deliver in Massachusetts, a program that matches volunteers with middle and high school students to receive tutoring in a corporate environment, providing exposure to real work experiences. And second, Science of Sports Science Fair in Massachusetts, a partnership with the New England Patriots and the Boys and Girls Club that pairs Raytheon mentors with students to create projects that explore math and science through sports. So on behalf of Raytheon, I am thrilled to be here with you today and to introduce the session topic and our speaker. So what is it that we're going to focus on this morning? We're going to learn about FLEX, in particular, flexing, which is the art of switching between leadership styles to more effectively work and engage people who are different from you. We all are experiencing and know well that the workplace is growing increasingly multicultural, female, and multigenerational, and younger. And with the excitement and the potential and the richness of texture that that enhanced level of diversity brings to the workplace, it brings a unique set of challenges as well. As Raytheon's Vice President of Global Talent Development, I understand and experience some of these challenges on a day-in, day-out basis based on the work that we do. Our work is to ensure that we create a ready and a strong pipeline of future leaders. And as we continue to grow our global footprint, let alone the multicultural, multigenerational reality that exists domestically, we need to learn how to build the skills and capabilities to manage this new opportunistic complexity of diversity across the globe. And so what does that mean in terms of the capabilities that our leaders need to be able to drive growth and to drive business through people? How do we communicate differently? How do we need to communicate differently? How do we build high-performance teams? How do we build trust with employees who bring to the table such a wide range of diverse experiences that may be and likely are very unique and different from those of the leaders themselves. So we're going to learn more about some very practical ways to both be thinking and to address those unique challenges. One other quick commentary relative to Raytheon. We stand out as one of the top companies for developing leaders. We were just named one of the top 25 global companies for leaders. We also strongly value diversity of our workforce. The Human Rights Campaign has named us a 2015 best place to work for LGBT employees, earning a perfect 100% rating for the 10th year in a row. So why do I mention that? I mention that because while this recognition emphasizes the significance both of leadership and of building and supporting an inclusive culture, it not only relates to today's session, but we have achieved that recognition still with the challenges that I've described. Raytheon isn't alone. I venture to bet that everyone who's in this room is looking forward to my moving on so that Jane can get up here and talk in more detail about how we address some of these challenges and opportunities. So let me move on, and I am so pleased to introduce Jane Hyun. Jane is an internationally renowned executive coach and global leadership advisor to Fortune 500 companies. She's co-author with Audrey S. Lee of FLEX, the new playbook for managing across differences. Her expertise is in the area of cross-cultural leadership. She speaks frequently on the topics of authenticity, culture, and fluent leadership. Jane is the author of the groundbreaking book, Breaking the Bamboo Ceiling, and has appeared on CNN, National Public Radio, and in the Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, and Fortune. Jane is a graduate of Cornell University with a degree in economics. She's passionate about helping people realize their fullest potential in their workplaces and in their communities. And I think it's safe to say that Jane and I are particularly close. We met about an hour ago. And I was delighted in the 20 minutes we spent walking from one room to the other. I think you will thoroughly enjoy Jane and everything she's got to say. So welcome, Jane.
Good morning. You know, you can get a lot done in an hour, actually. and we did. We got to know each other quite well in the short time. So are you guys all excited for the day? Okay, great. I didn't get to hear a lot of the keynote, but I hear just wonderful things about the different people on the panel, that somebody threw a frisbee, right? He came out in jeans and the hat, so there's a lot of fun things coming. We're going to talk about the concept of flexing today, the idea of flexing, you know, strategies for thriving in a multicultural and multigenerational workplace. And, you know, as we unpack that topic, I want you to really understand that, you know, flexing, the way that we're going to talk about it, is not about flex time. It's not about, you know, working part-time or figuring out a job share situation. I'm talking about actually flexing your leadership style. So how do we, as women, and then how do we, of course, I speak to men as well. In fact, I talk more with men about the issue of needing to flex your style with women in multiculturals and younger generations. But we as women also need to understand, how do we understand the complexities and diversity of the women in the room, as well as the different generations that we work with. And so as we talk about this topic, really think about, how does it impact you as a leader or as an employee? Or perhaps even as a service provider, you know, to your customers and your vendors as well. It has implications from that. So what I want to do today is give you a little bit of the business case. You know, why is this so important? I think Beth laid it out really clearly, right? The workplace is becoming younger, multicultural, and also more females in the workplace. And I think actually colleges are graduating more women from colleges than men. It's interesting, right? That's a huge difference. The language of difference. How do we even talk about differences? And I'm so pleased to see so many different cultural and ethnic backgrounds in the room. And yes, we have this diversity, but do we really know how to understand each other? Do we know the differences that we experience? Do we have different motivations? And what are some cultural implications on our communication styles? So I want to talk about some of those differences. And then we want to talk about what do we do about that? How do we flex our style? Right? What are some tools that we understand from both sociology, psychology, and cultural anthropology of how do we flex our style? How do we work with people who are different from us and not expect that they change, right? But assume that we have to meet each other partway, We have to figure out a place where we can part, flex to each other. It's not a matter of I do this and that's it, right? Or you do that if you really want to work with me, right? To understand those concepts as well. So I want to share with you a little bit about my personal journey. As you're probably thinking, so how do you kind of, you know, navigate this yourself, right? And you probably see in front of you some sort of an Asian woman, right? You know, with Hyun, you don't know exactly what Asian country that might be. You know, by looking at me, you probably see, okay, someone from the Asia Pacific, right, as far as background. So my background is that I am Korean-American, okay? So I was born in South Korea, and my family moved to the U.S. when I was 8.5 years old. And so I have to say that because I want to just make sure that you kind of know my heritage and my background as well. So to give you an idea, the experience that I had in South Korea, both in growing up there with my family and my community members, as well as the school system, was entirely different from the school system that I experienced here in the U.S. And I was fortunate enough to actually experience both, although it was not easy to adjust to that. So if you could picture with me a little bit, what's the school system like in South Korea? And I do believe that every culture has a music, right, and a sound and a rhythm to it. And the South Korean classroom is one of quiet, right, peacefulness. And the way it works is that there's a ratio of about 40 to 45 kids to one teacher. So the ratio is not that great. Right? You've got a lot of kids and one teacher. But the system works because in Korea, teachers are revered. Right? They're held in high esteem. And because they are teachers and they're in a place of teaching, the students are very quiet. There's no sense of questioning the teacher. In fact, if you ask too many questions in the classroom, you get punished. Right? The teacher is the one teaching and the students are the one learning. It's a very quiet classroom. There's no idea of questioning or discourse and dialogue. And in fact, you can't even disagree with the teacher because that's very impolite as well. Very different system. And also, at the time, South Korea didn't have any immigration, so everybody that I worked with looked like me. Right? There were no Americans, there were no Europeans, there were no Asians from other countries as well. So that was my experience in that classroom. Now think of that little girl moving to New York City. You laugh, right? It was a chasm of difference on so many levels, right? Because again, I was plucked from this homogenous place where everybody looked like me to a multicultural city where the first language I heard was Spanish, you know? Fascinating. This is not what the America I imagined, right? This is, so I was fascinated by that. And then in the classroom, I realized, wow, the rules had changed on me. Because what I saw in my classmates and my peers in that classroom those first few weeks of school was entirely different from the way that I was educated in Korea. Because what I saw was people calling out, right, volunteering answers, saying, "Miss Jones, I have a different opinion," right? And the teacher didn't punish him, right, because he had a different opinion. I just saw so many different interactions. What had happened was my cultural lenses hadn't changed yet, right? I had physically moved, right? I had been physically put in a new place. But culturally, I still had the cultural values, right, and the communication patterns and the expectations of my South Korean culture. And so I share this with you because as we go throughout this presentation and as you explore your own preferences for how you communicate and how you work, I would imagine that all of us in the room have had some type of experience where we had to go out of our comfort zone, right? Whether it's you were the only woman in the room, in the boardroom, or maybe you're the only person of color or of a different culture in a team that you're leading. In some way, you've probably had to walk into an environment where you were the only one. And so as we talk about these differences and the need to flex in these environments, really think about how you may have experienced culture in various ways as well. So I want to kind of ask you, and I want to get a little bit of the feel of the room, why is this conversation so critical to your work and to your leadership? Can I just hear from maybe two or three of you? Why is this so relevant at your companies, in society, in your communities? Yes, with the blue lanyard and the blonde hair. Yes.
The man who runs my company is 81 and our youngest employee is 25.
Okay, very interesting. So there's a huge gap there, right? Are you seeing some challenges in how they're working together or how they're not? Okay. Very good. Right. It's good to recognize that there is difference, right? Sometimes we just try to avoid the issue. Okay. Any other thoughts? Why is understanding difference or cultural difference important? Yes.
Retention.
Absolutely. So retention of diverse talent, whether that's women or multiculturals or younger people, they may have different motivations. They may have different ways to work. Absolutely. One more. Yes.
Innovation.
Innovation.
Through differences of opinion we get and communicating, having those differences of opinion can
Absolutely, absolutely. I love what you said there, because we're talking about not so much that diversity brings difficulty and challenge and strife, but about what the potential can be, right, of really tapping into the resources there. I think that's really important. I think this is where we're going with this conversation as well. So I want to share with you some stakes that I've noticed as I've worked with organizations and I've worked with leadership teams, you know, that are struggling with diverse teams, right, global teams, teams that are different generations. And what we have heard is that there are both people challenges on a leadership perspective and also business challenges, right? It's both. It's really of the moment in both ways. On the people side, conflict ensues. If you don't understand people from a different background, whether that's a different generation or a different culture or a different country, men and women certainly, you're going to have conflict. Sometimes you may not even know that there's conflict, but there will be conflict, right? There are different people have different ways of expressing that. Attracting and retaining diverse talent, right? The way that you do that needs to be customized to the people that you're trying to retain. It's one thing to hire a lot of women or hire a lot of multiculturals and younger people, but if you don't understand what makes them tick, what really values them, what really helps them make them feel welcome and appreciated in the company, you're going to lose them to someone else or a company that will really value them. And then team alignment. You know, as organizations merge, they do joint ventures and they divest of different businesses, you're going to work with a lot of different areas around the world and maybe even in the country. There's regional differences too. You know, the way that you find the difference there is also important. On the business side, as you implement things, right? I'm sure many of you in the room are in charge of operations or processes that need to be implemented nationally, right? It's maybe built here in Boston or developed here, you know, the brains of it, but then you have to implement it to all the five offices to make it work. You know, as you do that, you have to understand the cultures and the perspectives of those different offices as well. Maybe they don't need all the bells and whistles that you have here. Right? Maybe they need to adapt it to the local experience so that it'll be accepted more readily. Negotiating, language barriers, right? That's a big one. And then, of course, clients, market share. We're always, how many of you would say you're all trying to grow your organizations? Grow market share. Yes, absolutely. We got to grow our companies, right? If we're not growing here, we got to figure out places to grow. And if we are entering new markets where we're growing incrementally those businesses, we need to understand what they need as well and need to adapt that style. So I also want to share with you some statistics. Many of you have probably seen some of these already, but just to reiterate the power of women, multiculturals, and millennials, and really diverse employees in the workplace, higher stock price growth and increase in the bottom line. And so if you have more women in the boardroom and also in senior management seats and also on boards of companies, you will have higher stock price growth and increase in the bottom line. It's been proven. McKinsey studies, Catalyst studies have shown that this is the case. Really powerful. Credit Suisse came up with another study recently about that as well. So the power of women is documented, and it's visible. Women control 70% of global buying decisions. I don't know if Tory Burch talked about that at all as far as the power of that. That's pretty significant. 70%. Okay. Don't you want to know what they think? Don't you want to know what views and perspectives they bring to the table for your company? Multiculturals, they're 36% of the labor force. This includes African Americans, Asians, and Latinos, and have 3.3 trillion combined buying power. Pretty significant there as well. They can move market share for your organizations. I would bet that from a multicultural perspective, most of these companies that I've talked to, they haven't even started to tap into those markets, right? They haven't even begun. And then 80 million millennials comprise $250 billion in buying power. So I just want to share with you just the importance and the power of what we can bring, of what we can jointly bring together to business. So let's talk about difference, okay? So what is culture? Hofstede is a cultural anthropologist that has studied cultures. He's a Dutch guy who have looked at cultures around the globe, and he said it's the software of the mind. The software of the mind, what makes us do what we do, right? So the behaviors are visible, but we don't always understand what's going on underneath that, and that's what the culture is, right? What's accepted, reinforced, or rewarded within a particular social group, okay? What's expected, reinforced, or rewarded within a particular social group. So I'm going to talk about cultural differences. I just gave you an example of a cultural difference from a country perspective, but I'm also now going to go into individual differences. Right? How do you, from a stylistic perspective and a communication perspective, like to work, and how does that impact other people as well? I want to give you a question. What do you think? If you hire a diverse team of people, you will get better business results. If you hire a diverse team of people, you get better business results. How many of you would say, absolutely? Okay. Yes? Okay. So I think I got more than half. How many of you would say, not so sure, I disagree? Okay. So I got a smaller but stronger, strong few that have expressed that. Well, the answer is, it depends. Okay. Depends. Always a trick question there somewhere, right? So if you hire a diverse team of people, you will get better business results, but you need to have the right leader in place who understands how to leverage that diversity, okay? Who understands how to leverage and value those differences, okay? There was a study that was done a number of years ago at IMD Business School that looked at diverse teams and that looked at monocultural homogenous teams. He looked at a variety of different countries and sort of how these teams work together. And what he found was really interesting. The reason he did this study was to find out, does diversity really pay off, right? When you have a lot of different people with different backgrounds, isn't that just more chaotic, right? You know, does that actually bring better performance? And what he found was that diverse teams, so teams that were multicultural and had diverse backgrounds and all that, who didn't have the right leader in place, who actually suppressed those cultural differences, who actually didn't even want to talk about those things if conflict came up, did worse than the teams that were all the same. Makes sense, right? If you're homogenous and you come from all the same backgrounds, you have less points of conflict, you communicate in similar ways, and you have, you know, similar ways of doing things. However, the teams that were multicultural, that were diverse, that had the leader in place, that was culturally fluent, that had that that cultural fluency and know-how to say, you know what, we need to hear all the voices in the room. We need to understand what everybody at the table is thinking. And yes, it's difficult to work through some of the conflict that ensues, but because we do this, we're going to get a better product, right? We're going to get innovation. We're going to get more complex thinking out of this thing. Those teams did a lot better than the homogenous teams, okay? So the reason I share this with you is oftentimes I think when we look from a diversity perspective, you know, why do we even do diversity, right? How do we even advance this conversation? We do a pretty decent job of trying to bring in people of different backgrounds, whether it's women or people of different cultural backgrounds, and even certainly younger generations of people. But we don't always know how to tap into the full potential of those people, right? And we need to have leaders who are equipped with the skills to flex, right? With the skills to understand, how do I move past this conflict? Right, and not suppress these differences so people can't even be themselves in the workplace, but have them become truly who they are and fulfill themselves in the workplace as well. So that's the thing I want to share. Diverse work groups do not perform as well as homogenous groups unless differences are recognized and leveraged and valued, right? And say, I want to understand the experience of your generation, right? I want to know, you know, what your experience was like in South Korea. I want to understand, how does that impact the way that you work? Right? How does that help you make decisions? How does the point of view of a female perspective, you know, how does how you do work and how you communicate, how does that translate into, do we have a different way of creating a process here? Are we doing things all wrong? It's those conversations that will actually bring people to the table and create these opportunities. Okay? So how does culture look when we talk about differences? And so one way I talk about culture, you may have seen this advertising campaign a number of years ago, is one word could mean different things to different people. So here's the word status. Does status to you mean you are a highly decorated military officer? You're a four-star general. You've given your time in life to this country, and so you should get the status. You know, you've given a lot of yourself. Does status mean you're the oldest, wisest person in your tribe? For some, that should get the most status. Or does status mean you're a Hollywood starlet? You're famous. You have fame and fortune, and maybe this is Paris Hilton with her chihuahua, right? Depends on how we look at things. Depends on what we value, right? Or the same picture could mean different things to different people. And so I know it's difficult to read the white lettering on there. So you see here a woman with four young kids. It's a scary picture, isn't it? jumping around on the sofa. Is that a picture of privilege to you? So you think, wow, you know, I bet she's a stay-home mom, and she doesn't have to work, right? And so she's got this privilege of being there, right? And that's sort of what she does. Or is that a picture of sacrifice? Like, wow, you know, I wouldn't want to be her, right? That's not what I want to be. I want to be here, right? You know, she's given up a lot, right, to do that. Or is she a role model? I bet this is a weekend, right? And she works full-time. She's got a corporate job, too, and she's busy, and she's trying to balance everything, right? And this is who I aspire to be. I want to grow up to be like that, right? I want to have a family. I want to have kids, but I also want a career as well. So depending on where we come from, right, and where our experiences have taken us, one picture could mean a lot of different things. And this happens in the workplace, too. We experience things together, but we don't always interpret things the same way based on what we experience and our cultural experience and our communication style. So I want to talk about flexing, and then I want to give you two or three examples of how different styles work, how these influences play out. So as Beth mentioned, flex is the art of switching between styles to connect with those who are different from you. Okay? Again, switching between styles to connect with those who are different from you. It is not fundamentally changing who you are. Okay? So I want to make sure you know that. It's not about doing a makeover, right? And becoming a man, right? It's not about losing or compromising the core of who you are to be something else. But it's understanding who is your audience that you're trying to reach in a meeting or in a leadership team or in a situation that requires this, and knowing when to flex and adapt your style accordingly. And we're going to get a chance to actually do some of this today and see how it looks. So this is too large a room to probably stand up and do this, but what I would like you to do is maybe pair up with your neighbor. And I'm going to give you two statements in a minute on the PowerPoint here. And I want you to tell your neighbor, which of these statements would you typically agree with in dealing with difficult situations? Okay, so the first one is, in a conflict situation or when I have a tough message I need to deliver, I know how to get my point across very clearly. Okay, I use words and explicit communication to convey what's on my mind. And I live by the motto, say what you mean and mean what you say. Okay, that's me. Okay, that's the first alternative, okay? However, you might be more of the B style, which is in a conflict situation or when I have a tough message I need to deliver, I know how to maintain a cordial relationship. I use hints, body language, and tone very effectively. I know people know what I mean, even if I don't say it explicitly. Sometimes a more subtle approach works best, okay? That's the second alternative, okay? So think about when you're in conflict situations, what you typically like to interact with and how you like to prefer to engage. And then I'd like you to turn to your neighbor and ask your neighbor what he or she, what she, I think there's one or he, two he's in the room, what he or she thinks, and then also share what you would say is your dominant way of dealing with it, okay? Go for it. Come back. Okay. Okay, come back. Come back. You know, once we get going, right, it's hard to stop, right? Okay, everyone. So I heard a lot of good sharing going on here. So this is a good time to let it all out, right? So I'd love to hear from some of you. For those of you who have chosen A, can I hear from maybe one or two of you your perspective on that and what made you respond in this way? Yeah, I'd love to hear from some. Yes, in the front.
We were both just saying that it's being more direct.
Uh-huh.
Resolving conflict practically in our experience.
Okay. It just gets right to the point. It's efficient, right? It saves time. Excellent point. Yes? Who else? Yes. Sure. So her point was when you are more direct and can be very explicit with your comments, even in conflict, you could save time. Okay? So efficiency. Yes. Okay. So using very explicit language allows you to be very explicit and direct. Okay? Yes.
One-on-one and you're, it's a direct report that A style approach is right, but if you're in a consulting situation and you're bringing those together, then maybe B is the right approach.
Okay. So what they both shared was often it is that direct approach that gets the clear message across, but sometimes you may use the B approach. So there's a little bit of flexing already that they're experiencing already. Okay. Yes, in the back.
I guess my thought is that initially I want, I try to operate
Okay. That's right. So perception is important, too. That's right. And what she was saying was that if she's too direct, right, and over the top with that, she may come across as the angry black woman, which is not the perception she wants to convey. Correct? Yeah. Absolutely. So our ethnicity, right, and who we bring to the table cannot be erased from how we show up. Absolutely. Yes, in the front.
I'm in a new business area for my company, and I lean towards B because when you're trying to establish a new process and sell a new product for your company, there's a lot of mistakes. And there's also a very wide audience oftentimes on email.
Yeah.
So I try to soften the blow, really tailor the message so that it doesn't seem, condescending.
Sure.
To keep in mind everybody who's on these email communications.
Absolutely. So she was talking about when she's emailing and communicating, she wants to soften the message so that she tends to use more of the B, which tends to have, you can kind of keep the harmony of that, of everybody on that distribution list a little better. How about the B? I heard one B perspective. Maybe I want to hear from one other B who prefers or uses this approach more in dealing with conflict. Yes, in the gray. Yes. Yes. Good point. Good point.
However, I think that people that know me to be very direct. But when I am in a situation of conflict, I try and I come across as softening that approach, and then risk the message not being delivered with complete accuracy and people understanding it clearly.
Right. Right. So her point was typically she is direct. Right, in her communication style, but sometimes in times of conflict, she tends to use other approaches, right, to soften or mitigate some of the messaging. And this is absolutely right, because when we're talking about direct and indirect styles of managing conflict, there are various influences that create our perspective on what we use at what time. And so for those of us who are more on the indirect side, let's say on the B side, we have a lot of different strategies, right, that we use, right, to get our message across, whether it's hints or body language or the way we say something, or maybe we even tell another person indirectly that you hope that person will get that message to that final party, right? I've done that with my mother-in-law, with my husband, so that works too. Yeah. So that could be a factor, right, in using indirect. But what the challenge of being indirect is, sometimes people don't hear us. The direct folks are like, what are you trying to say? Right, I'm not getting that. Now, on the direct side, for those of us who are more direct, who are used to just telling people what I need from you and here's the problem, let's fix it, very efficiently getting all that out there, is it's very clear. Right? There's no doubt what you're looking for. The feedback is really, very defined. However, we may come across as a little harsh. Right, to those who are indirect, right, and may alienate some people who are not used to that kind of language, right, as well. So there's different ways that this is impacted. So I want to share with you some language and how to look at direct and indirect language and see what the variation of it looks like in one scenario. Okay, make sure that this analysis is on my desk by Friday. Direct. Okay, it's very direct. I'm sure many of you probably don't use this kind of language. It's kind of like, I want you to do this by this time, right now, right? Very direct. There's no question about what I'm looking for, but maybe not as nice, right? Not as kind, right, in the delivery of it. Please have this to me by Friday. I will need the analysis, okay? I think it's still direct, right? But you've added the please, and you've given them a reason. Whenever you give a reason for something, it softens it. It mitigates the message a little bit, okay? Could you have the report to me by Friday? Would that be possible? It's a little more indirect, right? It's question, it's not ordering the person to do it. It's a little softer. And sometimes this approach works too, depending on who's on the other side. I think we need to remember that it depends on the person on the other side, right? Because maybe there's some people who want to make sure that this analysis is on my desk by Friday. I know exactly what you need and when you need it. Let's get our deliverables together by Friday. Maybe we can get over our action items together then. Okay? That's more indirect. If you're very direct, you'd be like, so what do you want from me? Right? Right? That's nice, right? Or the senior executive committee and the board members will be at that meeting on Friday. On Monday. Okay? I'll tell you, if I said this in one of the Asian countries that I've done work in, like Thailand, or maybe even Japan, people would know exactly what to do. I'll get something by Friday, very specific guidelines, right? Because indirect people understand that message as very clear, okay? You don't have to say that much, right, to say that across. So I think the art here is not so much that direct or indirect is wrong or right, but understanding when to use and flex our style to work with the people we need to work with, to be as effective as we can. I think we're looking at effectiveness here, right? And so for those of us who are really direct, are there opportunities when we could soften our message? Are there ways to do that? For those of us who are more indirect and prefer that style in dealing with conflict, can we amplify our voices sometimes, even a notch, right, to be better heard by the people who are more direct and maybe need to see you as a leader in that way? Because the corporate business, corporate boardroom, which is the rules have been pretty much set by Caucasian males, right, is direct and emotionally restrained. Does that make sense, right? They like direct, very in-your-face language, but without too much emotion, okay? So if we know that that's the norm, it's helpful for us as we move forward, right, to understand how we need to navigate in those types of settings. So I want to talk about relating styles as well. So in addition to, we talked about that already. So cultural proverbs, say what you mean and mean what you say. That's an American proverb. It is good to know the truth, but it is better to speak of palm trees. Arab proverb. I'm not kidding you. This is very indirect, okay? But it's the talking and expressiveness is there, but very indirect and not dealing with the actual issue, okay? It's talking around it, right? It's a different kind of conflict resolution. Nothing done with intelligence is done without speech, okay? Direct, right? Greek proverb. Hear one and understand ten. Japanese proverb, okay? Very different. One message carries a lot of weight. So you don't have to say that much, okay? Another element of cultural difference is power gap. How do we navigate the distance between ourselves and people in positions of authority? Between ourselves and people in positions of authority. So power gap is the amount of distance you have. So if you have, for example, as the employee and manager in this slide, small power gap, that means your manager could be the senior vice president or the director or the head of the group, but the way you interact with that manager is very, very informal. Right? The power gap is very egalitarian. Okay? So you see your manager as, yes, head of the group, and she's a very senior person, but she's more of a coach or a guide. That's the relationship that you feel with this manager. From a manager's perspective, you think, yeah, I'm the head of this group, and I have this big title and a big office and everything, but, you know, I've got an open-door policy. You know, I want you all to feel like you can come into my office at any time. I want you to feel empowered. Right? You tell them, you could question my thinking, right, if you have other ideas, and I want you to bring your ideas to the table because I don't have all the answers. And if they really mean that, that's a very low power gap approach. Okay? And I think this is an important perspective to think about when you're thinking about generational difference and also cultural difference as well. However, if there's a greater power gap, what I call more a hierarchical perspective, between employee and manager, there's a greater distance, right? And so it's a conceptual distance, right? Not just physical distance. So the employee thinks about that senior vice president as, wow, that's a senior person. And I don't dare go into that office. He tells me he's got an open door policy, or she says, any ideas, if you have, you know, different ideas or divergent thinking, please let me know. I don't dare go in there. I need to schedule something with his assistant, right? Because he's a really busy guy. I don't want to bother him, okay? That's a little bit more of that approach. And then from a manager's perspective, if you're hierarchical, power flow is probably one way, right? And not in many different directions, okay? And the language you use and the formality you use might be different based on that as well, okay? And people have asked this. Certainly there are power gaps in peer relationships too. Just because you're at the same level as a peer in a different function doesn't mean you're at the same, you know, level in the company, depending on what function you're at, right? And so I think those types of gaps are important. I think the power gap shows itself also in how you treat your boss and how you respect your boss. So I think none of you would actually disagree with me when you talk about, you've got to respect your boss to a certain degree. Some bosses are not great, right? And they may not be the best managers in some cases, but we have to at least, in the workplace, show some level of respect. But what does that look like? For some of us, it's when we're in a boardroom, when we're in an important meeting with our manager, we don't say anything, okay? Either because of the high power gap or because he's the senior person or she's the one who's the expert, and so we're going to keep quiet, okay? That's respecting him or respecting her. For others of us, it's about engaging, right? Saying, if I'm going to show respect to my boss, I'm going to show how interested I am, I'm going to raise my hand. and show how excited I am. Different cultural perspectives in the boardroom or the meeting situation may have different views of this, okay? But both sides want to respect the boss, okay? Okay, I want to share with you one example of a generational divide. So one of the organizations that I worked with and also profiled in my book is a bank. It's a retail bank. I don't know if any financial services companies here in the room. Any? Okay. That did a lot of work, really kind of bridging the generational divide in the retail banking system. And so their retail banking system had some generational rifts that were going on where because people worked part-time as tellers, they had a lot of college students who were there working maybe about 10 hours a week or so, and then they had another generation of folks who were over 65, mostly retirees, who also worked part-time. And so you can imagine, right, Gen Y managing a 65-year-old team of people, or the other way around, where you had older generations managing the Gen Ys. And so it got to a point where they actually had a lot of conflict. Right, a lot of challenges in communicating and also perceptions of how well they're doing, right? This person's not competent, they're not with it, you know, all of these different perceptions that were not very healthy. What they found was that the Gen Ys, when they looked at their performance and their evaluation scores, consistently had higher transaction volumes. Okay? So because they were tech savvy and often used social media and knew when someone was online and they can go to the computer and figure out, okay, I got your number, they can cross-sell a lot of the banking products, right, really quickly. They can access all those systems and ways to find out different information that can help them identify those products. They were able to get those higher transaction volumes. So a lot of transactions were coming through. But they were low on the client service scores, the customer service scores. They didn't always know how to build the relationship with the customer, and the customers didn't always feel that level of engagement with them. On the other side, the older generations of workers had higher client service scores, right? Surprise, surprise, right? Oftentimes they would say, well, when I have people online, you know, waiting for me, I know many of my customers, you know, from working here for a number of years. And I know that gentleman over there, you know, I know the name of his grandkids. I know he just bought a dog. Right? I know what his interests are, and so when he comes to my desk, I know exactly what I need to do, right, to help him and to provide the level of service that I need to provide, right? But they had lower volumes of transactions, right, because they were spending more time on really developing the rapport with these individual customers, okay? And so I share this with you because both parties would say that they wanted to do a good job, right? Neither of them would say, oh, I'm here because I want to slack off and not, you know, have higher transaction scores. But it actually involved them getting them in a room and actually appreciating the cultural differences of how they did work, right? And valuing the other perspectives and actually learning from each other. It's like, well, how do you actually do these types of things, right? And how do you build rapport in a way that's not just kind of, okay, next, right? Next person online, right? And so I share that with you as one way where flexing and working together to understand difference really helped them. It also showed them the importance of relationship building styles, right? I think the older generations of workers would say that the younger generations thought of relationships as more transactional, right? It's kind of like we do it quickly, right? The more we can get through and efficiency is the best. Whereas they were more relationship oriented, right? They took the time to build the trust. Right? It wasn't just about the work, but it's about who they're doing the work with, and so they took longer times with that as well. I want to share with you a couple of traits of the fluent leader, and then share with you one example and then some takeaways as well. One of the things that I found when I was researching the book, I interviewed about 100 executives from a variety of backgrounds to identify what were the traits of the leader that were effective at leading across difference. Right? And so not just general leadership styles as a whole, like results-driven and communication, but who are the leaders who are effective at working with people who were different from them, whether it was working with women or different ethnicities and cultures or with generations? And, you know, I have to tell you, after you interview all those people, you realize there are not a lot of people who do it well, right? It's a real skill. But the people who do it well really had some of these traits in common. They possessed self and other awareness, comfort with ambiguity. And so when they were uncertain about something, when they saw something that was strange, when someone did something in a way that they wouldn't do, they didn't see that as a negative thing. They didn't judge it, right? They thought, this is something that I can learn from. Adaptability, and I think adaptability takes a certain level of humility as well, right? Thinking, you know what, I've got a global team now, and I've got to manage these people. I don't think my old methods are working, okay? And I have to change. I have to figure out how to adapt my style, to better manage the people that I have. And that took a great deal of humility and adaptability. Unconditional positive regard. Unconditional positive regard, which is not a new term, but I think it's important here in that when you're working with people who are different from you, you're going to make mistakes, right? You're going to have assumptions and you're going to have lack of awareness about how to work best with them, but you're going to need to give people a chance to take risks. And these leaders who are able to do that really did that. They're saying, you know what, you may not do this perfectly the first time, or I'm going to give you a stretch assignment that's going to stretch you, and if it doesn't go well, you'll still have a job here, right? I want you to know I'm behind you. They sponsored these people, and that UPR was definitely there. Innovation, and I'm going to share with you how that looks like, and then flexes across the power gap, knew how to manage the power distance across those differences. I'm going to share with you this one piece about innovation. So the innovation piece that I want you to have in mind is these folks who were really good across these differences were people who had this insatiable curiosity in learning about people and their differences, okay? They weren't afraid to ask questions. They weren't afraid to get into people's lives, right, and really understand what made them tick, right? One guy said he's the head of global procurement for a large company, and he worked in Australia, he worked in Asia Pacific, and now he's in the U.S. And what he told me was, I had to set aside my biases about what it takes to be effective and efficient. Because he realized in some of the countries he worked and some of the different relationship-oriented cultures he worked with, you know, you couldn't just have a conference call with them to really build that relationship. He had to go visit them more often, so that's not very efficient, right? You got to take all these trips all around the world. And he realized, I need to change the way I think about time management, because if I want long-term for these people to be engaged and to get the best out of this team locally, I need to do things differently, okay? And that's that heart of innovation, right? Innovation not from creating something new as a product, but thinking about how to do things differently and engaging differently as well. So I think I have, what, 12 minutes maybe? Okay. So I want to just end with this, and then I want to end with just kind of a tip slide, and I want to do some Q&A. The one other case in point that I have in my book is Memorial Hermann Southwest Hospital based in Houston. So I spoke with the CEO, George Gaston, who was really involved with kind of revamping their whole hospital. Their hospital was going through a time where, because they weren't doing very well and they were losing patients, they were about to close. They were actually about to sell the hospital to another entity. But somehow the sale didn't go through and didn't really work out. So he said, you know what, if we're not going to sell this hospital, we've got to figure out how to make this work. And so he was humble enough to say, well, let's find out what we're missing from our patients that we lost and the physicians that we have to really find out how can we get more market share. And what they found was they had a growing Asian community in that area, right? Just maybe a few miles from the hospital, a growing Chinese and Vietnamese community that they were not being served. They were not serving very well. And so they did research to find out, like, what do they need from us? You know, maybe some of them don't speak English. Maybe the food that we serve is not that great. You know, it doesn't really serve their palates. Is there a way that we're not serving the bilingual needs of that community in some way? And so they really did a lot of homework around that and reached out to former patients, family members, and physicians to get that. And what they created was a whole Asian care wing to serve the needs of the Vietnamese and Chinese community, okay? And so now, when someone from that community came to the hospital, you know, they can get congee, right, which is a porridge, right? It's a rice porridge they can get instead of something that they're unfamiliar with. They have a bilingual line, and they have actually staff that's bilingual that can actually speak to them in the language, and a number of services that they created as well. And as a result of that, they also began this interest in looking at differences, and they looked at the senior care wing. They were starting to see that a lot of the people who walking through the door who were older felt very uncomfortable with the chaos of the emergency room. And so they created a senior care wing so that they actually had a different entrance that they can walk through. And they had services. They had a nurse who came up to them right after someone came in, and they were able to escort them to the services that they needed. So really thinking about things differently from an organizational level really helped them to flex as an organization, I think, which I think says a lot about the leadership of the organization and what we can accomplish. So I'm going to just end with this one slide, and I'm going to take some questions. So as you think about how to build relationships across difference, here's some tips for you that I think we could just do tomorrow as you walk out the door here. First is take a risk, okay? Go out of your comfort zone with at least one new person who is not like you, okay? And I'm sure everybody in this room probably can get to know someone from a different culture. Maybe we can get to know a man, right? Maybe from a different generation that we don't know very well, that we don't understand very well, right? maybe you can get to know them. Maybe you can meet their family members. You can go have a meal with them. And think about over the course of a year how you develop that rapport with that person. Okay? Remain curious. Okay? Ask open-ended questions when getting to meet someone different, and remain curious and just listen. Okay? You don't need to judge anything. You don't have to make any comments. Value differences. Okay? Instead of judging difference, see difference as an opportunity to learn more. Okay? And if you keep that open mindset, right, that same open mindset that provides us with that multicultural thinking is the same mindset that drives innovation, right? That we suspend judgment so that we can understand a problem more complexly, right? So that we can make a decision that's a little bit more holistic versus from my own experience, which is often how we lead, right? We kind of come from our own experience and we think, this is how I see the problem and this is the solution, okay? The more we sit on a problem, we can actually come to a better solution as well, okay? So I'm going to take some questions now, but I will actually be at the book signing, I think, at 12:30, if you want to meet and talk to me there specifically. But I'm happy to speak to you about that as well. So let's take some questions. We can have, actually, do you want to come to the microphone so we can have some, we just have people line up here? It's a long walk, isn't it? So either microphone, I think, should work.
Okay, great. On the slide before, Jane, you talk about the three things to do. I'm curious, with the research that you've done with leaders, if any of those are harder for people to take or not, or just equally, and what you've learned from working
with
folks.
You mean as far as the different traits?
The three actions that you suggest that people do.
Oh, okay. Let me get to that.
Some actual examples and where people trip up.
Yeah, you know, I think flexing is just hard for people. And I think there's a general discomfort around talking and asking people about their backgrounds. And so I even think about my own personal experience. You know, my daughter's in eighth grade, and I know this, one of her close friends, you know, I know this family for a long time. And just a few years ago, you know, I think I took her to a Korean restaurant, and we were talking and stuff. And until that point, you know, she never really asked me, you know, about my ethnicity, about my culture and everything, until I really kind of opened up and kind of invited her into the conversation. So I asked her, like, you know, I wonder why you never did. He was like, well, I didn't want to intrude on that, right? I didn't want to be impolite, you know, and call you out as someone who's different, you know, in that way. So I think there's that propriety piece and our desire to respect, you know, people in that way. But I think that keeps us from genuinely really knowing each other, really engaging on a deeper level in some way. So obviously that helped, because as we had the food and we talked about why we have this food and how the culture is very communal and all that kind of thing, we had other conversations. But it, you know, took 6 years, right, for us to have that conversation. And I've known this family for such a long time. So I think we need to open up more, but also ask questions more as well, so that we can start to have these dialogues. Yeah. Okay, yes.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
I really enjoyed the part of your talk about flexing to different styles as you need to, leadership styles.
Yep.
In the company that I work for, which is very, very male-centric, there's oftentimes, because I'm in a leadership role, that I'm in a meeting with, let's say, 20 gentlemen and myself, and their style is very direct, very to the point, sort of blunt, if you will. And then I also manage a team, and so I don't want to have like heavy hand when I manage my team, so I have more of a softer approach to work with my team. And so I was thinking about, and would love your perspective on, there are approaches that a woman can take in leadership style that actually men would be able to learn from. And so when, you know, I tend to then, in those peer meetings, be more blunt and straightforward, but isn't there also opportunity to have a new perspective in the room on even just approach with how you engage with them?
Absolutely. So there's so many layers to your question. I mean, we could talk for about 30 minutes about what you need to do, right, in this room full of 20 men, and also what they need to do. So I think from your perspective, I think it's good that you're doing, kind of bringing your conversations to the more direct place so that they are able to hear you in their language, right? They are able to hear you clearly, and they can do what they need to do around it. I think from a flexing from their perspective, I absolutely agree that they need to think differently as well, right? And so I'll give you an example of a place and time where a colleague was able to do that. So you would think that only the people who are employees need to flex, but actually management can also do this as well. So a colleague of mine who works in finance, she has a partner she works with. So she works as I think she's a VP level person, and she has a partner that she usually pitches deals with. So when they go out to meet potential clients, they partner up, they kind of create this pair, and they go out to a team together to do that. Now, the personalities are very different. So her style is very much thoughtful. She's very very much someone who does homework, right, on the context of the client. And whenever she meets or is getting ready to meet a client, she actually, you know, goes on Google to find out, what is this person who I'm meeting with? Has he ever been speaking before in other areas? What is the personality and the style of this? Because I want to understand how to adapt my style. So she naturally does this kind of a thing. She's a little bit of an introvert too, right? So she doesn't want to have any surprises, right, as well. So that's kind of her approach. Now, her partner's style is entirely different. He is, like, loud. He would say he's charismatic, right? But, you know, he's loud. He's very much a salesy kind of guy, really smooth talking and, you know, very salesy, you know, in a way that you can imagine what that sounds like, right? And so she's been in meetings with him before where she's just kind of like, you know, I hope we don't lose this deal, you know, because, you know, he's doing that. So she did some homework on this one potential client and found that the client they were going to pitch to was the head of this school, actually, this large academic institution. And they were trying to raise money and that kind of thing. And found that this guy was actually very much a cerebral fellow, right? Has a PhD, very thoughtful, very intelligent on things, and probably would not be bowled over by her partner, right? That style would be completely almost offensive, right, to that. So she actually took a risk. And because she couldn't make him flex his style, so she actually took a risk and went into his office and said, you know what, we're going to have this meeting tomorrow. And I checked this guy out, and I've done some homework on it. You know, you might need to tone down your style a little bit, right, and have me take the lead, right, because I think he's got a different approach, and I think knowing his leadership perspective and what he appreciates, he may not necessarily take your style as readily, right? She said it very nicely, but I think pretty clear, made the point across to that. And he was agreeable, saying, okay, I trust your judgment. I think you've made the right call in a lot of areas. And so when they went to the meeting, he had her start the conversation and actually made the pitch, right, made the presentation and everything, and things went okay, right, and they actually got the client. Now, you might say, well, maybe they would have gotten the client anyway, right, with him doing his thing, but I think what she did there was helped him to value her perspective, right, helped him to see if you flexed and did something different in this new situation, you could still be there and you could still talk, but if you are aware of the nuances of things and didn't have to be so in your face about things, it could still be very effective. So again, it's about the audience, right? It's about how do you become effective with that? And then you could show your value even more. And I bet from that point on, he never negated any of her thoughts, right? Like, she got this credibility that you can't take away. So I share that with you as just inspiration maybe, right?
Yeah,
and some tools to think about.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have time for one more question?
Why not?
Okay, let's take one more. And then we'll wrap up. Yes.
How are you?
Welcome. Yes. Hi.
Thank you. I have like a multi-question now, tons of things in it. So my team at work is made of the four, you know, I have four generations in my team. And I think they work really well together. And I don't know if it's conscious or unconscious that they are able to work well together and understand each other in their different styles. And
right.
I found that I'm not doing too much to promote that. So it's great to see them work like that.
Okay.
That what we don't have is the diversity of understanding the background and the cultures, including myself. You know, I'm curious about other cultures, so if I have a team member who's from another culture, I'll ask, because I'm from a different background. But as far as them knowing that culture and the background, I don't have that. I don't see that. And I'm just wondering, do you have any ideas on how to, you know, promote that? Because they're unconsciously already acknowledging the generations and the differences, but they're not really with the cultural.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as a leader, you know, yesterday one of my staff members asked me a question about my background. I've been there for 15 years, and that's like the first time somebody asks. I don't know how much to share as a leader about my background, because, you know, is it appropriate to, or do you just kind of like put the brakes on?
So. Yeah. Well, again, multi-layered questions, right? You guys are all, you know, you have big jobs, I think, and definitely these layers are there. So I think on the first part of kind of having a multicultural and multi-generational work team, I think as a leader, you could definitely set the tone. right, about a healthy way of engaging in that. And I think it doesn't have to be so much that you have to go around the room and everybody has to talk about what their country is and all that and what generation they're from. I think there's a different way you can do that. You can maybe do an icebreaker, right, or a team building kind of a session where the question that you throw out will allow them to share something very personal about themselves. And that could be something that's very important to them. So actually, if you're here, I'll share with you some examples. So it could be something about, you know, what, you know, how, you know, tell me about your name and the meaning of your name, right? And how that is relevant to your identity. Something like that, right, can open up things really quickly. We could talk about, you know, some of the cultural dimensions maybe you can identify, and you could kind of zero in on that and say, you know, how do you guys respond to that? Talk about a current event, right? How does that impact you from where you stand? So those are just some very basic ways to kind of get the conversation rolling. I do think that if you have a more facilitated setting where, for example, we have these cultural fluency roundtables that we've done where the objective is to bring the multicultural team to lead more effectively as a team. Right? And so when you're doing that, the objective is to understand those differences and bring self-awareness to each person around it. But you can even do that, you know, informally now so you can get the conversation rolling. And I think you sharing more about yourself, I think that would be very powerful, actually, and can actually create more people to feel comfortable with that as well. Yeah. Okay?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. To Jane again, quickly, another round of applause.